All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Virtual RNA Club. Today, we have two exciting speakers. We have Dustin Niblett from the Knoller Lab, and then we have Daniel Kim from the Kim Lab. So we're going to start off with Dustin, and today he'll be discussing a slippery saga, the implication of domain 4 of elongation factor EFG in the maintenance of the translational reading frame.
Yeah, thanks, Ali. So hello, everybody. Thank you all for joining. I'm excited to talk a little bit about some of my current research into elongation factor EFG and its role in maintaining the translational reading frame. So to start things off, I wanted to introduce the star of the show today, elongation factor EFG. So EFG is an enzyme in bacteria that catalyzes translocation on the ribosome. And we can see here on the right a very lovely structure of EFG bound to a ribosome and a translocation intermediate. So translocation is the coupled movement of tRNA and mRNA through the ribosome in three nucleotide steps. And it is well established that tRNA can be actively translocated, but the mRNA, on the other hand, appears to be moved passively by virtue of its base pairing interactions with the tRNA. And this three base pair interaction is relatively weak, but it is nonetheless very important that it is maintained. And this is because unpairing of this duplex can result in desynchronization in the movement of the tRNA and the mRNA, which in turn can result in a frame shift. And frame shifting errors are much more dangerous than substitution errors. This is because while a substitution error only causes a single amino acid change in a protein, a frame shifting error results in a continuous series of incorrect amino acids and leads to termination at out of frame stop codons. So this leads to the generation of truncated and misfolded proteins, which in turn can have dominant lethal effects on the cell. And the importance of maintaining the reading frame is reflected by the low error rate of approximately once per 100,000 codons compared to around once per 1,000 codons for substitution errors. But these errors are context dependent. And in some cases, frame shifting appears to be less of an error and more of a feature. So in programmed frame shifting sites, we have stimulatory elements in the mRNA, which can cause the ribosome to switch reading frames. These elements include an upstream Shine-Delgarno region, a slippery sequence, and a downstream secondary structure in bacteria. So examples of this have been found in every domain of life. This allows for the production of two proteins from a single gene, which can be co-regulated. And in the case of the DNAX gene from E. coli, which I have shown here, the frame shifting efficiency is as high as 80%. So a really cool structure from our lab from a couple of years ago revealed a ribosome translocating in the absence of EFG. And if we look at the codon-anticodon duplex in this structure and compare it to one in the presence of EFG, where we have mRNA codons at the top, and tRNA anticodons at the bottom, we can see what a normal duplex is supposed to look like. But in the absence of EFG, the duplex had become disrupted and the tRNA had actually moved further than it should have, resulting in a minus one frame shift and directly implicating EFG for a role in maintaining the translational reading frame. So here we can see a structure of EFG interacting with the codon-anticodon duplex with two highly conserved loops at the tip of domain 4 making direct contact. And these are good candidate positions for residues that could be playing a role in this reading frame maintenance. So previously, a former member of our lab named Charlotte Nelson conducted a global screen for dominant lethal mutations in EFG. She did this by performing PCR mutagenesis on EFG in a plasmid where expression could be repressed by glucose or induced by arabinose. She transformed these plasmids into cells and replica plated them on glucose and arabinose to turn expression off and on respectively. And anything that grew on glucose but not arabinose was scored as a dominant lethal candidate. So for example, up here, we see some cells in boxes that were very happy on glucose, but not so happy on arabinose. And she screened through a lot of mutations and found dominant lethal mutations mapping to every single structural domain of EFG. But in particular, there was an unusually high amount mapping to the two conserved loops at the tip of domain 4. So we were interested in what was wrong with these mutations and what effect they were having on translocation. So we tested their ability to catalyze multiple rounds of translocation in a tau printing assay. In this assay, a radio-labeled primer and yield-10 mRNA is extended by reverse transcriptase. And upon hitting the ribosome, it falls off. And the length of the resulting cDNAs tells us where the ribosome is on the mRNA. And we can see that all of these mutations are fully functional and catalyzing three rounds of translocation. So next, I tested these units in vitro translation, where they are now tasked with catalyzing several hundred rounds of translocation. And I tested these in the presence of wild-type EFG and in the absence to monitor the dominant effects as well as the effects of the mutations by themselves. And we can see here that only one of our mutations had an inhibitory effect in the presence of wild-type. And in the absence, two of them were completely inactive, but the other five were totally functional. And it was still really unclear what exactly was wrong with these mutations. But neither of these assays have the ability to pick up frame shifting. And based on the information that I gave at the beginning of this presentation, we thought that that was a next good step to look at. So to test for frame shifting, I took the programmed frame shifting sequence from DNAX that I showed earlier and inserted it into the mRNA for in vitro translation. This wild type sequence has a frame shifting efficiency of 80%, but other researchers have observed that deletion of the stem loop results in a lower efficiency of only 20%. And for the purposes of our studies, we wanted to start with a lower number so that it would be easier to observe an increase. So I omitted the downstream stem loop in our studies. And when we translate this new mRNA in vitro, we see the production of a new protein product of the same predicted size as our expected frame shifting product. And not only this, but it is greatly stimulated in the presence of our mutants. So I once again tested this both in the presence and absence of wild-type EFG, and we can see that even in the presence of wild-type EFG, this has an effect demonstrating that this phenotype is dominant. Over here, we can see a histogram showing the relative amounts of frame-shifted product to full length, and these numbers went up even more in the absence of wild-type EFG, with our strongest unit, Q507D, having a relative amount of frame-shifted product that was about 7 times higher than wild-type, so a really big increase. And next up, we wanted to confirm that what we were seeing really was a -1 frame-shifting product. So we used the following setup. What we have here is when the ribosome is translocating across the slippery sequence, if there is a frame-shift, it will then hit an out-of-frame stop codon, either here or here. If this is a frame-shifted product, then we would expect that mutation of the stop codon to, for example, a glycine, should result in the ribosome instead moving forward to the next stop codon over. So we're expecting a -1 frame-shifting product, and this -1 read-through mRNA should lead to a 3 kilodalton extension in the size of our product. So here we can see that the -1 read-through mRNA did give us the expected disappearance of our original product, along with the reappearance of a new larger product, confirming that we are in the -1 reading frame. And this is true in the presence of all of our mutations as well. So this is a schematic representation of EFG interacting with the codon-anticodon duplex. We can see that the mutated residues that we have that were strongest, Q507, H583, and D586, are making interactions with the tRNA anticodon, as well as with position 37, which is also well known to be important for decoding. And this is that same thing, but just a molecular view where we can see Q507, D586, and H583 interacting with 37, 36, and 35. So it's clear that these mutations do have an effect on frame shifting, but what effect do they have on the rates of translocation events? We reasoned that by looking at the kinetics, we could get some insight on when exactly frame shifting is occurring in our system. So one assay that we have is mRNA quenching. By labeling the mRNA with a fluorescent pyrene molecule at position +9, upon translocation from 9 to 6, this pyrene interacts with the ribosome and the fluorescence is quenched, which gives us a readout on translocation. And when we do this, we can see that there's a broad range of defects for our mutations, from Q507H, which is very similar to wild type, to S587 and 588P, which were largely inactive. But these mutations are not completely dead. When we extend the time course out from 5 seconds to 5 minutes, we can see that they do eventually translocate, although they are about 100 times slower than wild type. This result explains how we were able to see these mutations function in tau printing, but not in vitro translation. So we can also look at the rates of ribosomal rotations using FRET. For example, by labeling the large subunit and the small subunit, we can observe inter-subunit rotation. Upon EFG catalyzed translocation, there is reverse inter-subunit rotation from the hybrid state to the classical state, which can be observed as an increase in FRET. And we can also monitor 30S head rotation. So upon EFG catalyzed translocation, the head first rotates forward, bringing the codon anticodon forward 3 nucleotides. It then rotates backwards, leaving the duplex in the new position and resetting the ribosome for the next round of translocation. So from this, we saw similar results to our mRNA quenching, where mutations had a broad range of defects and typically fell in the same order for every step of translocation. For example, Q507H was always similar to wild type, and S587 and 588P were usually mostly inactive. The one exception to this is that Q507D, while it was in the middle for most of the steps of translocation, it was the slowest in reverse head rotation. So it was unusually defective in one particular step. So to talk about how this all fits in with a kinetic model of frame shifting, basically what we have is that in the kinetic model, the maximum level of frame shifting occurs at an equilibrium between the 0 and the -1 reading frame. And this is determined by the free energy difference between the two reading frames. So in the case of DNAX, we have an anticodon UU and then a modified U interacting with an AAG, but it actually has a strong preference for an AAA in the -1 reading frame, which explains the high efficiency of this particular sequence. However, having a stable -1 interaction is not enough to get efficient frame shifting. And this is because there is a large energy barrier to frame shifting. So the rate at frame shifting is generally a lot slower than the rate of translocation, such that the ribosome can make it across a slippery sequence without this equilibrium being approached. And this kinetic barrier consists of interactions between the codon and the anticodon, as well as interactions between the duplex with ribosomal RNA, and importantly for our study, interactions with EFG. And upon forward head rotation, some of the interactions between the duplex and ribosomal RNA are actually broken. So for example, A1492 and A1493, as well as G530, which isn't pictured here in the back, all lose contact with the duplex upon forward head rotation. And it is at this point in translocation that new contacts are formed between the duplex and EFG. So you can think of this as a handing off of the duplex from the ribosome to EFG, such that it is never left unescorted during translocation. And we would like to emphasize that this is the point in translocation where our mutations are operating. And we think that this is a convincing argument that this is the point in translocation where frame shifting is occurring in our system. Additionally, from our EFG minus ribosome structure, it appears that EFG is having an influence on the shape of the tRNA. So we think that EFG can hold the tRNA in a conformation that favors base pairing and also restrains it from uncoupled forward movement, as was seen in the absence of EFG. So putting this together, we get the following scheme where frame shifting is a balance between the rate of translocation and the rate of slipping. We start in the classical state and we have EFG catalyzed forward head rotation to the chimeric hybrid state where it becomes vulnerable. And much of the literature has been focused on this step right here, where it is well established that slow translocation can result in frame shifting, although I don't think it has typically been looked specifically at reverse head rotation. But we wanted to focus a little bit more on here on duplex stability, which hasn't gotten as much attention. Unfortunately, when we look at the things that affect these two steps, EFG mutations that break contact with the duplex tend to affect both steps. So it's a little bit difficult to deconvolute the effects of each of these processes on frame shifting. But we do have some data points that are useful for this. For example, Q507H we think is a really good example of a mutation that shows that breaking interactions with the duplex can increase frame shifting even when rates of translocation are kept the same. So just about all of our fluorescent traces for Q507H overlap really well with wild type EFG. And when we look at the rates, they are all either slightly slower or slightly faster, but generally about the same as wild type. But despite this, we have about twice the amount of frame shifting. Additionally, we have another mutation outside of domain 4, which is very far away from the duplex that is very fast in translocation. And this mutation has a hyperaccurate phenotype where it actually has less frame shifting than wild type. So we think these are two good examples of how both duplex stability and rate of translocation are both contributing factors to frame shifting efficiency. And when we look at the rates, we see another thing where it's a little bit difficult to deconvolute the effects of different rates. And this is because when a mutation is defective in one step, it is typically defective in others as well. And when we graph them, we get a line and it's hard to tell which rate is really the main cause. But Q507D is much, much slower in reverse head rotation than it is in the other steps. And when we plot our rates versus frame shifting, we see that most error points stay in the same position, but Q507D is in a spot that correlates better with reverse head rotation. We understand that we don't have very many data points specifically for this, but we think that when you put all the information that we've shown together, that you can start to come up with a compelling argument that EFG is playing an active role in reading frame maintenance through its contact with the A-site duplex in the chimeric hybrid state, and that the chimeric hybrid state is likely the point in the translocation that is most vulnerable to frame shifting. So in the future, we're interested in solving the structure of these mutant EFGs bound to the ribosome, preferably in a chimeric hybrid state through cryo-EM. We also have this frame shifting assay, which we can use to look for more mutations in EFG, ribosomal RNA, and other genes. To quote Harry, he says, once you have a hammer, you want to go out and find some nails. So lastly, we're interested in the effects of the stimulatory loop as well. Other researchers have seen that translocation is slow due to these stimulatory elements. But to our knowledge, no one has specifically looked at head rotation. So with that, I want to acknowledge the members of the NALAR lab for being so helpful to me along this way, with Harry and Laura being really great mentors that have been super patient with me through this whole process. And this project had contributions from a lot of members of the NALAR lab, both current and former. So I'd like to thank all of them for everything that they've done, as well as thank everybody here for listening. So thank you.
Thanks, Dustin. I wanted to also mention that I'm pretty sure, Dustin, you did all of this work before you started your first year of grad school, right?
Yeah.
Super impressive.
Yeah, this is finished. Just a little bit before I started that.
Yeah, nice job. All right, well, we're gonna open up to questions. Looks like we have one from Alyssa already.
Yeah, that's really nice. Do you have an idea of like what interactions have to be broken and then remade during a frame shift? Like what has to let go and is it, do you think it's kind of a big letting go and sliding over or a slow, and is it kind of the energy of translocation or some of these movements within the ribosome that's providing that driving force?
That's a good question. Definitely the codon-anticodon duplex needs to be broken. And if we're correct about EFG kind of restraining the tRNA, it would have to break free from that group as well in order to move from, for example, here to here. As far as, I guess, how the ribosome is driving that, I think is what you're asking. I'm not 100% sure on the details of that, but definitely these interactions would need to be broken. Yeah, I hope that answers your question on that.
I have a quick question.
Oh yeah.
So essentially you would need you're showing that it's much more likely if the ribosome is going more slowly. Mm-hmm. So you could look at potentially the probability of a frame shift by looking also at the just in advance of a potential slippery sequence. I would imagine GUs will decode much more slowly. Oh, sorry. GUs will there are certain anticodon codons that are decoded more slowly, like GUs as opposed to GCs are decoded more slowly. So I imagine you could look for higher probability of frame shift by looking at the context of the slippery sequences around it.
Oh, that's interesting. Like a sequence dependence on the rate and how that affects.
Yeah, you. Exactly. Yeah, so if things are slowing down, and then you have a high probability for a slippery sequence.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. Anyway. Have to think about that.
So kind of in thinking about that, you know, with your kinetic model, right, the lower energy state was the being able to make more base pairs, I guess, codon, anticodon, more base pairs. How often do you think that difference is between the, I guess, the currently coded state and the frame shift? Is this something that the ribosome encounters often, and that's, you know, a strong selective pressure for EFG activity? Or do you think that it's a result of something else that EFG does?
I might be slightly misunderstanding your question, so this DNAX gene, which is one of the most efficient frame shifting sites, in the absence of all of these stimulatory elements, the frame shifting efficiency is really low at only like 1%. Under normal operating conditions, these slippery sequences aren't, I mean, this one, 1% could still be bad, but I think that they're not as big of a deal usually, that the ribosome can just translocate right through it, unless there are extra elements there to slow the ribosome down. Is that kind of what you were thinking of?
Yeah, I guess. And so is EFG there? It's a fidelity. It's enforcing fidelity in a way. And is that its most important job? Maybe that's my question.
Yeah, I don't know. It has a lot of functions, as well as like ribosome recycling. It really is doing a lot of things, EFG. So this definitely is an important function, though, I would think.
Are there any more questions for Dustin before we wrap this up? All right, cool. Thanks, Dustin.
Okay, thank you, everybody.
That's awesome. So we'll go ahead and switch over to our next speaker. And that will be Daniel Kim, who I believe I made co-host, so you can share your screen now.
Okay, great. Thanks for the opportunity to share about some of the work that my lab has been doing to look at RAS-driven cancers. In particular, we're trying to develop these RNA liquid biopsies for the diagnosis of and early detection of RAS-driven cancers, such as lung and pancreatic cancer. So I'll be sharing some of the work that we've been doing in this area to discover some of these potential RNA biomarkers and also applying it to patient samples as well. So let's see if I can advance. For some reason, I cannot. Oh, okay. So as you know, everyone here knows, most of the human genome is transcribed into RNA, and there's evidence that only about 1-2% of the genome makes proteins, but the rest of it seems to have some evidence of activity in terms of the transcriptome. generating RNA. And so based on ENCODE and a lot of these other studies that have been done using these high-throughput sequencing platforms, it looks like anywhere from 75 to maybe 80% of the genome is making RNA. And so in the context of liquid biopsies, this is important because for the most part, when people talk about liquid biopsies, most people have been looking at circulating DNA, so cell-free DNA that's released from cells that are dying and basically just having fragmented pieces of DNA that are in the blood, where people can try to diagnose diseases such as cancer, looking for these very short stretches of DNA. Whereas for the RNA, it's actually kind of nice because the RNA is protected in these extracellular vesicles that I'll be telling about a little bit later. And so the RNA is in fact in a quite pristine state when we isolate it from biofluids such as the blood. And so there's a lot of potential in terms of mining kind of the transcriptional output of different cell types and different tissues in terms of being able to understand diseases such as cancer. But we've also been looking at other diseases such as COVID-19, and I won't go into that today. But if anyone's interested, I'm happy to share some of the results that we've been getting in terms of trying to better understand how individuals respond to SARS-CoV-2 infection and how the transcriptome, in particular the circulating transcriptome, can inform our understanding of how the disease is evolving in the patients. So there's a lot of potential for looking at RNA in terms of being able to both diagnose but also better understand diseases such as COVID-19. But again, for today, I'll just be focusing on cancer. And so we know that, you know, there are tons of different classes of non-coding RNAs. I'm sure some of your favorite non-coding RNAs might be on this screen here. And so what we know is that, for example, a lot of link RNAs or long non-coding RNAs are encoded within the human genome. There are estimates that suggest that there are upwards of 58,000 of these long non-coding RNA genes in the human genome. And this is based on looking at over 11,000 different RNA sequencing data sets that are out there. But I think that, you know, with the advent of doing all of these human cell atlases and looking at the single cell level, we're probably going to be discovering a lot more of these RNAs that are very context specific or cell type and even developmental stage specific. When people talk about kind of the non-coding RNAs within the genome, typically, you know, these are the favorite ones that people talk about. But I'll also mention that, as many of you know, most of the genome is actually, well, not most, about half of the genome is comprised of these repetitive sequences or transposable element derived sequences. And so what we know is that a lot of these transposable elements, such as these line elements and ALU elements, for example, are actually transcribed, and they have a nice poly A tail, which allows us to be able to detect them when we do standard poly A based RNA sequencing protocols. And so oftentimes, you know, people kind of discard these multi-mapping reads. They're like, that's not important. It's just going to, you know, make things confusing. So a lot of the times people don't even look at this. So for example, if you look at the Cancer Genome Atlas, this is, you know, over 10,000 different RNA sequencing data sets that people have generated from different patients across all known human cancers. And when you look at kind of the data that's available, there are no annotations for repetitive elements or transposable elements. So everything is typically for protein coding and a handful of RefSeq, for example, long non-coding RNAs or other more kind of well-studied or well-known non-coding RNAs. But in fact, when we look at a lot of these RNA sequencing data sets and in fact look at the reads that map to these transposable elements within the human genome, we see that in fact these are quite enriched in a lot of these diseased states such as cancer, and also in COVID-19, for example, there are a specific set of TEs that seem to be specifically upregulated in these individuals that are infected. And so what we're trying to do is to understand how, for example, in the context of cancer, are these non-coding elements, such as these line and sign elements, being dysregulated in the context of cancer. And so our lab is really interested in RAS signaling and how it perturbs the non-coding transcriptome. And as probably everyone knows, RAS is a very important gene involved in cell proliferation. And in cancer, oftentimes it acquires a gain-of-function mutation that allows it to be constitutively active. And for example, we know that in pancreatic cancer, the vast majority of these cancers have mutations, activating mutations in KRAS, colorectal cancers as well as lung cancers. And at least in the case of lung and pancreatic cancers, these seem to be initial hits or initial events that occur in the process of transformation. And so a lot of the effort that we've been kind of focusing on is to do early detection of cancer. And so in order to do that, we want to know what are the initial kind of molecular changes that occur in response to this this initial hit in oncogenic KRAS? And how does that, in fact, regulate kind of the non-coding output of the genome or the non-coding transcriptome? And so we wanted to basically use a really simple system to do this because really when people talk about the RAS signaling pathway, this is a very well-characterized pathway with hundreds of known components, all protein coding, of course. This is a very simplified version of the RAS signaling pathway. This is from Frank McCormick's lab, a review that he wrote a few years back. And so you could see that these are kind of the main players, but if you look at kind of the broader kind of signaling pathway, there are, you know, over 200 different protein coding genes that are part of this signaling pathway. But as you'll appreciate from this slide, as well as basically any review that you look at on RAS signaling, there's no known role for RAS in kind of regulating these non-coding RNAs and how these non-coding RNAs could be involved in this signaling pathway. And so what we wanted to do was initially focus on KRAS to see how does it affect, again, the non-coding transcriptome. And so we used a very straightforward, simple system. This is just an in vitro system where we have human airway epithelial cells that are transformed in culture when you just introduce mutant KRAS. And so this is a model that was developed by Bill Hahn's lab at the Dana-Farber, where essentially if you introduce this mutation in KRAS and implant these cells in mice, they will grow tumors. Without the KRAS mutation, they won't grow tumors. And so this is a nice, simple, again, in vitro model of the initial kind of transformation event that occurs just with a mutation in KRAS. And so we wanted to see when we introduce this mutation, how does it, again, perturb the non-coding transcriptome? And how is this process potentially regulated? And so what we did was we just performed a few transcriptomic assays as well as an epigenomic assay. So we looked at bulk RNA sequencing to see, again, how are these RNAs changing? We wanted to look at kind of the heterogeneity of the response of these cells to the mutation in KRAS. So we performed single cell RNA sequencing. And again, we wanted to look at kind of the epigenetic regulation of these genes and non-coding RNAs that were responding to mutant KRAS signaling. So we looked at ATAC-seq data as well. And again, this is to really get at this non-coding RNA signature of mutant KRAS. And you know, going back to kind of the initial aspect of the talk in terms of looking at liquid biopsies, again, the purpose of this was to really see, can we identify very early RNA signatures that we could then use as kind of molecular markers of this early oncogenic event, which could then be kind of detected in the circulation in the blood. So I'll tell you about that a little bit later. But we know also, basically, when we do this this transcriptomic analysis, this is just bulk RNA-seq data. I'm showing you these human airway epithelial cells, basically transformed with mutant KRAS. And here, this is just a volcano plot showing you the significantly differentially expressed genes. As you can see, a lot is going on in response to KRAS, as you might expect. We also wanted to look at kind of an unrelated cell type to see, you know, what is kind of the tissue specificity of this response. And this is just from these kidney, human embryonic kidney cells that also have this feature of when you simply introduce a mutation in KRAS, these cells also undergo oncogenic transformation in vitro. And so again, if you implant them in mice, they'll grow tumors. And so in this similar system, which again is unrelated, it's a kidney cell line, we see a different set of genes that are significantly differentially expressed. Again, here, upregulated genes on the right, downregulated genes on the left in these volcano plots. And so when we did some gene set enrichment analysis to see what are the different pathways that are being turned on by mutant KRAS, we see at least for these lung airway epithelial cells, the most enriched gene sets are these interferon-related gene sets. For example, interferon alpha was the most significantly enriched GSCA pathway. But when we looked at these kidney cells, it was kind of the opposite effect. We see that, for example, these interferon response genes are actually being downregulated in these kidney cells. And so this seems to be kind of a specific response to the lung. And we've actually now been kind of collaborating with Angela Brooks's lab to look at a related lung cell type. So these are human bronchial epithelial cells that have also been transformed with mutant KRAS. And we see similar responses as well in those lung cells where these interferon-stimulated genes are being significantly upregulated in response to this mutation in RAS. We wanted to see specifically what are these interferon-stimulated genes that are responding to KRAS, and again, this is in the lung cells. We can see they're all being upregulated or not really changing. There's not any interferon-related genes that are being downregulated by this mutation in KRAS, and so we were just calling this the KRAS ISG or interferon-stimulated gene signature. And then when we looked at basically other hallmark interferon-related genes. And so these are just hallmark interferon gamma and interferon alpha response genes. We can see that there is some degree of overlap with our KRAS ISG signature. And then we also looked at a different data set. And this is from a paper that was published by Novartis not too long ago, where basically what they showed was that if you look across all human cancers, there's this intrinsic interferon-stimulated gene signature within these tumor cells. And so for whatever reason, they seem to be turning on these ISGs. And we think that a lot of that might be due to upregulation of the RAS signaling pathway. And so when we looked at the single cell data to, again, assess kind of the heterogeneity of the response of these cells to mutant KRAS, here I'm just showing a UMAP of the single cells from these mutant KRAS lung cells. We can see the different clusters, as well as in terms of the gene sets, we see, for example, that all of the clusters have this upregulation of these KRAS signaling genes. But what was interesting and quite surprising is that if you look at kind of the interferon, the hallmark signature, as well as the signature from that paper that I mentioned, as well as our signature, we see that even though it's induced in a lot of these other clusters, it seems to be most highly induced in this subset of cells in cluster 4. And so when we looked at the ATAC-seq data, again, we're looking at chromatin accessibility to see if there are changes in the accessibility at the promoter regions or regulatory regions of these genes within these gene sets. We see, for example, for KRAS signaling genes, there's an increase in terms of the accessibility of the chromatin very proximal to the transcription start site. We see that, for example, in our KRAS ISG genes as well. So we think that this might be due to kind of an epigenetic effect where the KRAS signaling is in turn opening up the chromatin at these genes that are involved in KRAS signaling, as well as these interferon response genes. And so here, this is just showing you the UCSC Genome Browser tracks for the ATAC-seq data, again, showing the accessibility of the chromatin, as well as the RNA-seq data. So here, if we look at just a few different interferon-stimulated genes, we could see, for example, that in this IRF9 gene, that there is some open chromatin already at the 5' end, but then in the context of mutant KRAS, we see that there's an increase in the accessibility. And then at the RNA level, there's some degree of expression, which is increased in the mutant KRAS cells. And this is more dramatically represented by, for example, OAS2, where there's no peak at the 5' end. So there's no chromatin accessibility here, which is corresponding to very low levels of RNA signal in these cells. But then when you introduce mutant KRAS, we see that there is a strong induction of this basically open chromatin conformation, as well as upregulation of the RNA as well. And here I'm also showing you for a different gene. And so we think that this is due to some epigenetic process where some of these transcription factors that are downstream of oncogenic KRAS and that RAS signaling pathway that I showed you are indeed kind of remodeling the chromatin at these transcription start sites of these interferon-stimulated genes. And so we wanted to see, are these kind of ISG signatures a response to something that's happening in the non-coding transcriptome? We know from a lot of recent studies that have basically treated cancer cells with these DNA methyltransferase inhibitors, that when you treat these cells with, for example, 5-azacitidine, this leads to this upregulation of these transposable element-derived double-stranded RNAs. And so what we see is that, for example, when we have mutant KRAS cells, again, I'm showing a volcano plot of the differentially expressed genes based on bulk RNA sequencing. You can see that there are these transposable elements that are significantly upregulated, as well as some that are downregulated as well. And what's interesting is that there are a lot of ALU elements that seem to be upregulated. And for a lot of different ALUs, they seem to kind of be in these inverted repeat conformations within the genome where they can form these double-stranded RNAs, kind of this stem loop structure where they kind of fold back on each other. And so we think that potentially these ALUs are inducing kind of this double-stranded RNA response, basically turning on these interferon-stimulated genes. When we look at kind of the expression of these different TE classes across the single-cell data, we see that, for example, the ALUs are relatively consistent if we look at all ALU RNAs in all line. LTR and MER seem to have kind of a stronger signal in cluster 2. But then when we look at individual elements, for example, this is a single L1 element, and this is also a single ALU element, and these are among the two differentially expressed TEs. So here, sorry, I'm just toggling back and forth, but this is L1MC4A, which is here, and then here you have ALU-SX, which is here as well. So these are both, in the bulk data at least, they're both significantly upregulated. They're basically high across all of the single cell clusters, But what was surprising is that when we looked at the editing status, the RNA editing status of these different TEs, we see that only in cluster 4 do we see a loss of RNA editing. And so again, this corresponds to the cluster that had the highest interferon stimulated gene signature. And what was also quite interesting is that when we look at these double-stranded RNA sensors within the cytoplasm, for example, MDA5, which recognizes long double-stranded RNA, we see that it's only kind of highly induced in cluster 5, where the RNA editing levels are the lowest. And again, this was where the ISG signal was the highest overall. RIG-I also seems to be more significantly up in cluster 4. And interestingly, PKR, which also recognizes double-stranded RNA, seems to be kind of consistent across all the clusters and perhaps a little bit higher in cluster 4. And so we think that this is due to this, again, differential RNA editing that is occurring in cluster 4. And so we wanted to see what is the potential mechanism for how these TEs are being upregulated. And what was really quite striking is when we, again, did differential expression analysis with the bulk RNA-seq data for these lung airway epithelial cells that had mutations in KRAS, we see that there's this global downregulation of these crab zinc finger genes. And again, crab domains are these repressive domains, histone-methyltransferase activity for K9 trimethylation and induce heterochromatin formation. And so when these are all being kind of significantly downregulated, what we see is that based on a lot of these publicly available ChIP-seq data sets, a lot of these ZNFs, KZNFs that are being downregulated have actually shown to target the TEs that are being upregulated in our system. And so we think that this is potentially how these TEs are responding, where these crab-finger genes are kind of globally being regulated in the context of these oncogenic KRAS cells. And here you see, for example, in the ATAC-seq data, so here these are the control cells with just the empty vector alone. And so you can see the very nice peak, 5' end of these different KZNFs. And when you induce mutant KRAS, again, this peak goes away, 5' end here, as well as here, as well as here. And so we think that silencing of these KRAS loci. You can also see, for example, the RNA level is high in, for example, the control cells, and then in the mutant KRAS cells, it's pretty much turned off. And so we think that again, mutant KRAS signaling is inducing this chromatin remodeling at these ZNFs and silencing them in the context of mutant KRAS. And so here, this is just the publicly available ChIP-seq data that I mentioned before. So we worked with Jason Fernandez in the Hauser lab when he was here, and basically looked at all of these different data sets using the UCSC repeat browser. And so this is the consensus sequence for these different repeats. And you can see that based on the ChIP-seq data, these are ZNFs that are all being significantly downregulated within our data, within our mutant KRAS cells. And these are the TEs that are being significantly upregulated. So we do see that there is very strong signal in these ChIP-seq. That so you think that these are potentially regulating the TEs directly, and we're actually looking at that using some KZNF cell lines. Just to kind of see if what we're seeing in vitro is actually relevant to in vivo cancers, what we did was we looked at the cancer genome atlas data. So this is TCGA data for all known lung adenocarcinomas that have mutations in KRAS. And so here, these are the different mutations that we looked at. And we compared them to normal tissue from the GTEx consortium. And so these are obviously wild-type KRAS cells. And so we can see these are all, again, the KZNFs that are significantly downregulated in our system based on mutations in KRAS. And we could see that in normal, lung tissue, that there is relatively high levels of expression of, for example, ZFP92. Whereas if you induce this mutation in KRAS in the context of cancer in vivo, there's relatively low levels of expression. And this is true across all of these KZNFs. And these are all significant, statistically significant differences across all of these in vivo samples. So we think that this is potentially a generalizable mechanism where mutations in KRAS lead to this kind of global downregulation of these KZNFs in the context of RAS-driven cancers. And so this is kind of the model that we favor right now, where initially, if you have an oncogenic mutation in KRAS, this leads to both the epigenetic silencing of these KZNFs, which I showed you through the ATAC-seq data, as well as this epigenetic activation of these ISGs, which again is indicated by the ATAC-seq data, where these chromatin accessibility peaks are increasing in the mutant KRAS cells. We also see an induction of these repetitive non-coding RNAs, and we think that there are two potential mechanisms for how this might be happening. One where when there's a loss of KZNF, this leads to a loss of repression of these TEs and these repetitive non-coding RNAs. And secondly, we also see evidence that for at least a subset of these non-coding RNAs, if you look at, again, their ATAC-seq peaks and how they're changing within these data sets, we see that, for example, there are motifs for these downstream RAS transcription factors that are found at these repetitive non-coding RNA regulatory regions. And we also think that there's this additional interplay between the non-coding RNAs as well as the ISGs, where not only is there epigenetic activation, but potentially also activation through RNA-mediated kind of these double-stranded RNA sensors are being kind of induced to stimulate these interferon-stimulated genes. And so if anyone is interested, we posted a preprint on this a few months back, so feel free to take a look at the preprint, and the paper is currently in review. And so secondly, I wanted to really quickly, since I don't want to take up too much time, just tell you about some of the work that we've been doing to also look at the extracellular RNA. So what we did was we took these same samples and then we isolated these extracellular vesicles and then again performed bulk RNA sequencing to identify what are these extracellular signatures at the non-coding RNA level of mutant KRAS. And again, can we leverage this information for early detection of cancer using these RNA-based liquid biopsies? And so here what I'm just showing you is some nanocyte data showing you the size distribution of these exosomal or these extracellular vesicles that were isolated from, again, the cell culture media of these control cells or the mutant KRAS cells. So we can see that, for example, the control cells that the size is about 200-ish nanometers in diameter. But interestingly, when you look at the mutant KRAS cells, there's a bit of a shift where the extracellular vesicle size is a little bit larger. But there's also this additional kind of smaller peak here, about 150. So this 300 to 150 nanometers, this is kind of a canonical exosomal size range. And so when we did RNA-seq, basically to see what RNAs are kind of preferentially loaded into these extracellular vesicles, what we see is when we did a comparison of the intracellular versus the extracellular RNA-seq data, we see that again in these volcano plots that there is a significant enrichment for example, long non-coding RNAs in these extracellular vesicles. And so we want to kind of leverage this, this kind of interesting phenomenon where these link RNAs are being significantly enriched and preferentially kind of shuttled out of these cells. And a lot of these link RNAs have transposable element sequences embedded within them. And so we think that these TE-derived link RNAs are going to be a very promising potential marker for early detection of these RAS-driven cancers. And so, sorry, really quickly before I end, this is just kind of conceptually showing you what is typically found in these liquid biopsies. And so when people, again, talk about liquid biopsies, they focus on these short fragments of cell-free DNA that are being shed from these tumors. But, you know, any cell that turns over within the body is potentially releasing these fragments of DNA. But what's really nice about the RNA is, again, they're packaged in these extracellular vesicles. So they're protected against degradation within the blood. And what we're trying to do is, again, trying to find tissue-specific signatures within the blood. And so the nice thing about link RNAs, as many of you know, a lot of them are highly tissue-specific and even very disease stage-specific. And so we think that looking at the link RNAs, and especially also these TE-derived link RNAs, we're going to be able to find both tissue-specific as well as even mutation-level-specific RNA signatures in the blood to do diagnosis, where we can just simply see what's happening in these tumors based on these extracellular vesicles that are actively being shed. And what's nice about RAS-driven tumors is that the RAS signaling pathway is actually involved in kind of the biogenesis of these exosomes. And so RAS mutant cancers preferentially pump out these exosomes with the RNA payload. And so the signal is going to be potentially higher due to kind of this increased exosomal RNA biogenesis as well. And so just to give you a brief sense of what the data look like, we wanted to look at pancreatic cancers, especially because we know that KRAS mutations occur very early on, and there are no good early detection strategies for pancreatic cancer. This is one of the most deadly cancers And it'll probably be the second most deadly cancer, I believe, or it may already be. And so we wanted to kind of use the RNA information to do early detection of pancreatic cancer. But just as a proof of concept, we looked at a few patient samples from pancreatic cancers where we looked at the plasma. Here, what I'm showing you is just the different biotypes for extracellular RNA in the plasma, again, of healthy individuals. These are age and sex matched individuals to these pancreatic cancer patients. And so here, this is just showing you just the location of these different RNAs across the human genome. And so we see that there are indeed a lot of link RNAs that are being released across the human genome in these pancreatic cancer patients. You can see that there are a lot of protein coding genes as well. And what was interesting is when we looked at, for example, the differential expression across both the control versus the pancreatic cancer patients, we see that when we look at these gen-code annotations, and this is again mostly protein coding, but also a lot of the long non-coding RNAs, and we compare that to, for example, the repeat elements, and so this is just using the repeat masker elements within the UCSC genome browser, we can see that there is this very significant and specific enrichment in the pancreatic cancer patient plasma for these repetitive element RNAs. So these RNA reads are mapping to these repeats in the human genome. And so oftentimes the signal is extremely robust. So there's very high log two-fold change as well as very significant enrichment based on the p-value. And so when we look at the different clades of these TEs, we see that by far sign elements are super enriched in these pancreatic cancer patient plasma samples. And so we think that this is going to be a very strong and robust signal for doing RNA-based liquid biopsies for pancreatic cancer detection. And so again, the goal is to do tissue-specific kind of and mutation-specific analysis to be able to identify kind of where in the body these signals are coming from. Because again, one of the disadvantages of DNA is that when you're looking at these short fragments of DNA, there's not really a good sense for where in the body these pieces of DNA are coming from. Now with looking at, for example, methylation, there's better kind of tissue specificity that's provided. But again, these are very short fragments, and the only fragments that survive are the pieces that are wrapped around these nucleosomes, so maybe like roughly 150 base pair fragments, whereas the RNA is pristine. Again, they're like full length, they're intact, and we're getting, again, active release. So the cells don't have to die, they're just continuously churning out these exosomal RNAs. So we're trying to do that right now to develop this type of RNA liquid biopsy for both pancreatic cancers as well as lung cancers. And again, we're doing this for other diseases such as COVID-19. And kind of future direction, we're also trying to do this using direct RNA, using nanopore sequencing. So hopefully that'll work. I know that the input requirements are pretty high for direct RNA, so we might need to get a lot of blood samples. But we're hopeful that this will work because in addition to being able to provide both kind of full-length transcript information, we think that also being able to look at the modifications, kind of the epitranscriptome, if you will, of these extracellular RNAs will also be potentially quite informative for diagnosis purposes as well. So with that, I'd just like to really thank all the people in the lab that contributed to this work. So this was really driven by Roman Reggiardo, a grad student in the lab, with assistance from Sri and Haley and Dave and Aaron, Lila, Jason, etc. I got to also thank our collaborators at Stanford, for example, Lucan Demirji, Mehmet Ozin, and Georgi Marinov, as well as our collaborators at UCSF, Eric Collison and Shivani Malik, and the Broad Institute as well, Jung Kim. This is a pre-pandemic picture, so it's a little bit dated. Just one quick plug before I end. There will be, if anyone's interested in liquid biopsies, there will be a UC kind of system-wide liquid biopsy summit that will be taking place later this month. And so I'll be speaking at that, as well as one of the speakers will be from Berkeley and UCSF. So if anyone's interested in liquid biopsies, this is a free online Zoom summit. So I can put the link, the registration link, in the chat if anyone's interested in participating. So with that, thanks very much for your attention, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Great, Daniel. I have a quick question. I know it's maybe a little bit controversial, but do you think any of these link RNAs that are being secreted into exosomes, do you think they are acting as messages and going someplace else and promoting the tumorigenesis or metastasis?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's funny. There was a review that just came out like yesterday from Mike McManus. It's in Nature Reviews. Basically, he's kind of posing this question of, is there actual functional kind of exosomal RNA in mammals? Because like, for example, in C. elegans, he makes some nice arguments about kind of how RNA is transmitted to different cell types. But yeah, in terms of whether it's actually kind of maybe even like seeding these new metastases that might be occurring, I think that there's some evidence that definitely suggests that, where if you, for example, take exosomes from a cancer cell type and you introduce them into non-transformed cells, there do seem to be kind of hallmarks of transformation that can occur. But most of this has been done in the context of small RNAs like microRNAs. And not a lot has been done in terms of looking at kind of the longer RNAs like link RNAs or these T-derived RNAs. I think it's a really kind of open question right now in terms of like what is the functionality of a lot of these exosomal RNAs.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thanks.
Yeah. So it looks like there's a question in the chat. Do you see this same interferon enrichment in the other KRAS-driven cancers, pancreatic, colorectal? Okay, great question. We have not looked at colorectal at all, but I'm really interested in looking at that. In the context of pancreatic cancer, we have not looked at that in the same way. So the system that we're using for the lung studies, it was kind of this, you know, early model where we're introducing mutations in the KRAS. We have not yet done that for pancreatic cancers. We've only looked at kind of established cancers. So we don't know if we would see kind of a similar response very early on just with mutations in KRAS. We do have a model system in the lab that we're going to hopefully try one day to induce kind of the same phenomenon of KRAS-driven transformation. That's definitely an open question. But as I was referencing before, there's a paper from a group at Novartis where they looked at these interferon-stimulated gene signatures across many different cancers, including pancreatic and colorectal cancer. And it does seem to be kind of a consistent pattern across many different cancers where there is this intrinsic interferon-stimulated gene signature within these tumors. And so, I think it's going to be something that's potentially broadly seen across different cancers.
Daniel, may I ask a question? Yes, Camilla here. Super interesting. I was wondering how you think about this, mainly in terms of a diagnostic, or are you thinking like more mechanistically? What is the, I mean, we all know that KRAS mutations are important for cancer, but mm-hmm. which pathway dominates and what are the cause and effects in terms of link RNAs versus, you know, canonical pathways? Is that something that you're going after?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're trying to do both. We're trying to look at both kind of the mechanism as well as develop kind of a diagnostic as well. So a lot of these kind of in vitro models that we're looking at, both in the context of cancer as well as pluripotency, where we've perturbed KRAS in, for example, human iPS cells, we're trying to understand mechanistically how does RAS affect kind of the secretion of these specific biotypes of RNA, for example, link RNAs. Is it that, you know, link RNAs as a class, which is again this very like probably it's not a good kind of classification because it's based on this arbitrary size cutoff, right? So just being able to understand how does this signaling pathway kind of affect which RNAs are shuttled preferentially into these exosomes and maybe even involved in, for example, development. We're definitely interested in those types of questions. And then in terms of the diagnostic piece, we do have kind of a grant that we got in collaboration with Stanford, where we're going to be looking at early lung cancer patient samples, and not only using kind of the liquid biopsy approach, but also using very state-of-the-art imaging modalities, molecular imaging, to really look at these very early lesions in the context of lung cancer to see, you know, as the patients progress, as they're, you know, treated with different types of therapies, like how does this kind of exosomal RNA signature change over time? So we're definitely trying to kind of develop this kind of as a useful clinical diagnostic in collaboration with clinicians at Stanford as well.
Just because I'm a stem cell biologist, I'll have to ask this. Is there any differential secretion of these exosomes by, you know, cancer initiating cells versus bulk tumor cells? Or is it mostly, you know, at what level does that happen? And what does that mean, you know, in terms of, you know, the diagnostic value of these exosomes or the link RNAs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have not looked at, for example, like cancer stem cell like cells versus not, but Dave is actually working in my lab, is kind of working on something similar where he's trying to induce stemness in these cancer cells through hypoxia, for example, and to see like what are kind of the changes that occur at the non-coding RNA level, and also looking at potentially exosomes as well. So definitely, I think that it's not clear whether there are kind of differences between, for example, these tumor initiating cells versus versus not. And then, you know, just in the context of stem cell biology, we're basically doing these experiments. I think Sri is on the call. She's doing these experiments where she's differentiating these human-induced pluripotent stem cells into the different germ layers to see, for example, like how does RAS affect the transcriptome? And we're also going to be looking at the extracellular RNA as well to see is it somehow facilitated through these extracellular vesicles and these RNAs. Like if we were to, for example, remove, for example, the extracellular vesicles from one particular cell type, let's say we differentiate into like neural stem cells, for example, and we add that to another cell type, does it kind of acquire, you know, features or properties of neural stem cells? I don't know. Those are all kind of open questions that we're trying to kind of address using this system. So yeah, I think that it's not really clear if they have an important role or not in pluripotency or early embryonic development. But yeah, we're interested in those questions and we're actively looking using the iPS models.
Thank you.
So it looks like someone has a raised hand. Is it Lina?
Yeah, it's hello. Yeah, it's Lina. Hello, hi. First of all, thank you so much for this wonderful talk. I'm actually tuning in from overseas. I'm actually from Switzerland. So sorry if I sound a little bit tired. It's actually really late here. No, but anyway, I was just wondering, I think it's very interesting that I guess in recent years, there's been this link discovered between non-coding transcripts and the immune system and human disease. I think this is a more and more emerging connection that has been drawn. And I was just wondering, because you were talking in the first part of your talk about how these transcripts could potentially be recognized by receptors. And I was just wondering if you're considering maybe perhaps looking a bit closer into these receptors, which I think are, for example, like toll-like receptors and all this, because for instance, from my own research, I focus on DNA-RNA hybrids in our model organism, which they can be problematic nucleotide structures depending on the context, actually. And there's a particular example when if you mutate one of the nucleases that can get rid of these structures, this can provoke an immune disease, an autoimmune disease called Aicardi-Goutier syndrome. Mm-hmm. And this is the reason for that is basically a constant activation of these receptors, and this leads to chronic inflammation. So I was just wondering, I mean, it might be a bit of a stretch because it's two different processes, but I was just wondering if you would consider maybe looking into that to get a bit more insight in the mechanism, perhaps.
Yeah, that's a great point. So we've looked at the toll-like receptors. We don't really see any changes, and they're in fact expressed, I believe, at pretty low levels in these cells in general. So it may not be through a toll-like receptor-mediated mechanism. But yeah, in terms of the sensors, we've done a few experiments where we've knocked down some of these double-stranded RNA sensors, such as MDA5 and RIG-I. And surprisingly, the cells actually don't like it. So the mutant KRAS cell, so Sri did these experiments where she knocked down MDA5 and RIG-I using RNA interference, and essentially showed that the cells kind of lose viability in culture. So it seems a little bit counterintuitive that they're not happy when you get rid of these sensors. So they prefer kind of having this level of increased interferon-stimulated gene expression in these oncogenic mutation backgrounds. So yeah, we haven't looked too carefully, but those are just some of the experiments that we've tried.
All right. Thank you so much.
Sure.
All right, if there are no other questions.
I've got one more quick question.
Sure.
Daniel, you said that the signs seem like they may be involved because they really come up in expression.
Yeah.
The signs in primates are mostly derived, you know, they're ALU mm-hmm. Type signs, but in mouse, most primates, they're tRNA derived. And so that how conserved do you think this mechanism is, or do you think it's very primate specific, some of the things that you're dealing with that maybe is harder to study in mouse, because if there are these mm-hmm. fairly recently derived signs, they're not going to be the same.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Thanks, Todd. So yeah, we do see that they're predominantly primate-specific TEs that are being dysregulated. So ALUs are the strongest mm-hmm. signal. And so it's quite interesting, like the older TEs, they don't seem to be doing anything. They're not changing at all. But for whatever reason, these kind of primate-specific TEs, not just ALUs and signs, but also LTR-derived elements, they're the ones that initially respond to this mutation in KRAS.
Huh. So
something about kind of the fact that they're, you know, more primate specific, maybe they're more, I don't know, I guess maybe less epigenetically stably silenced. I'm not sure.
Right.
The DNMT experiment is interesting, but also for us, like we're seeing it kind of more at the level of histone methylation changes instead of
right. DNA
methylation. So the TEs that we see are different from these people that have done the DNMT inhibitor experiments in these cancer cells. And we think that perhaps, yeah, maybe these primate-specific TEs have not kind of been stably silenced through DNA methylation. Maybe they're still dependent on KZNFs for their repression, such that when there is this global downregulation of KZNFs, they're just being cranked up in these cells.
Right. Pretty cool. Thanks.
Cool stuff. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. See you next month.
Thanks.